Les colloques du Collège de France.
Now I have the honor to introduce the last speaker of the session, Josh Tenenbaum. Josh did a training in physics and PhD in brain and cognitive sciences before establishing his work in MIT, where he is a professor in computational cognitive science. His extraordinary work stems from an apparently simple question: how do we humans get so much from so little? So without wasting more time, I let the floor to Josh. Thank you.
Okay. It is an incredible honor to be here. It's also a great honor to be the last speaker, and especially in the session on the human singularity. The title of my talk is, if you didn't catch it, Scaling Intelligence the Human Way, and I want to give you my own take on this. And I thought, especially since it's the end of the day, let's start off with a little bit of a fun demonstration. This is for all of you to participate with, but there's a few people in the front row who will be able to be more active, let's just say. Okay, so now, where will the dot go next? Okay, well, so people have some idea, we can see. There's a lot of, let's just call it uncertainty. Okay, well, so that's where it actually went. Now, where will it go next? Interesting. Doesn't really look like a Gaussian distribution, does it? But it looks like something. We might call it structure. Yeah, okay. That's where it went. Now, where will it go next? Okay, I think you got the idea. Yes, we've all got the idea that we've all got the idea, and that's really the point of the talk. Just to show you, this is an actual experiment. I mean, again, in this experiment we showed people three things, and then these are the predictions that a group of our participants made, and you can see that it basically reproduces exactly the same pattern here, which is very much in the spirit of, you know, how do we get so much from so little? From a couple of examples, you see people making informative and, I would argue, rational predictions. They have uncertainty. They have a really interesting kind of structured uncertainty that you see with these different peaks. And then after just a couple more points, it really converges to something that looks more like a Gaussian, right? Whether it's motor noise or motor control or just whatever. In this case, it's probably mostly motor control. There's a rapid convergence to the point that we all know what's going on. Okay, so this is just one illustration of the human singularity. You were able to do this with very minimal instruction. How do you do these kinds of things? This, as many of you also surely recognize, was an experiment that we did that was heavily influenced and directly inspired by studies that you saw from Stan's lab and other collaborators like Mariano Sigmund, with like the language of geometry for the eight-dot octagon points. And I'll come back to that at the end, but this was an experiment that we did to try to get a language of thought not only in encoding and memory, but also in probabilistic inference, generalization, inductive learning, indeed program induction, like Matthias referred to. Okay, and this is just one of the many deep ways that my work and thinking has been influenced directly and indirectly by a truly singular human. Stan, happy birthday, Stan. We've got to know each other. So, what?
I think there's two on the picture.
Well, no, there's just one. That's what singular means. But we've got to know each other in many ways. I don't actually remember the first time we met, but I remember especially interactions around science, math, and art, like with Phyllis and many others here at Loup-Radou, where we were sitting inside an art exhibit where we looked up and saw that, could you believe it or not? Or Stan took me on my last trip to Paris. We walked around in a colder time around the Gardens of Versailles. Probably many of you have been there, maybe even with Stan, and experiencing these artistic realizations of human thinking and creativity have been deeply inspiring. Another way that I've been inspired by Stan, as well as by many others in this room, is to ask whether I wanted to say also, like, a thing that I think I and some of the most recent speakers here, others from Stan's colleagues, come from, is we represent one of the many different threads of thinking in Stan's work, which is the more theoretical, mathematical, computational side. You're many different kinds of scientists, Stan, but you are also a mathematical and theoretical psychologist. And in that, I deeply resonate and have been inspired. But I've also been inspired by, for example, my colleagues and longtime friends and colleagues in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Nancy Kamischer, Elizabeth Spelke, who are here, many others, to ask questions like these, the big questions of our field. So it's, you know, like Stan's Dehaene questions, you know, I'm interested in these big things. What kind of computation is cognition? What is a concept? What is a thought? I think a lot of the discussion here has been very salient on that topic. How can we learn everything we learn, given such little evidence? How do our minds work so efficiently and flexibly? It's a remarkable machine. It's an engineering marvel. At the same time, it has limits, and minds can break in ways that we really want to understand and try to figure out how to repair. That might be related to trying to understand how minds work mechanistically in the brain. That may be some of the deepest questions. How do our minds arise? What are their origins in evolution, development, and culture? And maybe something that confronts all of us here, right? How is it, as Stan and others raised, how is it possible for minds to be able to come to understand themselves? So like others in this last session, like Stan, I think going back to some of his earliest interests, we've been deeply inspired by what is effectively a long history of bidirectional interactions between the call it the engineering and the reverse engineering of intelligence. Artificial intelligence and cognitive science really grew up together. And there's a long history of back and forth idea flow, very productively, as you've been seeing here. And certainly that's been the story of my career as well. As, again, I don't even need to say, this story has entered a new chapter with the rise of forms of AI that are not just academic disciplines, but are in everybody's lives, like language models, ChatGPT. You can't even do a Google search without getting AI, basically. And it's not just language models. You know, we now have robots in the real world that actually like are there making life or death decisions, probably saving more lives than not, but not always. If you've been to San Francisco, or some other US cities, you've seen these Waymo self-driving cars. It's really quite remarkable. But not to take away from the remarkable advances behind the AI industry that companies like Google on both sides here have been doing, there is still something really quite different about the kinds of intelligences that you see in these systems, and I think the technology and the math that leads to them. There's many ways to see this. Nancy in her talk talked about the jaggedness of AI and so on in physics. But there's a sort of very meta-jaggedness here, which is each of these systems was engineered at great cost by huge teams of engineers over a long time. And you know, one of them you can talk to about any topic. The other one you can drive on, well, any street within the 7x7 square miles of San Francisco. But one does one and the other does the other, and nothing does both, right? Whereas our minds, our brains, can do both of these things. And not only that, as my colleague Laura Schultz likes to point out, it's profoundly not developmental, right? The large language models are actually released, everybody's using them. Whether they're safe or not is an interesting question. Whereas self-driving cars have been much slower. You know, the ChatGPT took everybody by storm over a couple of years. The Google car has a history going back almost 20 years, and in many ways before that. And it still doesn't work well enough that you can just put it out anywhere. It has to be in a very delimited place. And there's humans behind the scenes ready to bail in when the car gets confused. Okay? And that's true for any car, even when you don't see a driver behind the wheel. There's a driver farther away that's ready to get behind the wheel if they need to. Not only that, right? When children learn this first. before we've mastered all the world's knowledge that you could get by reading text on the internet, if we ever do, we can drive a car. And it's not only humans. Non-human primates can effectively drive too. So there's something almost backwards about the Silicon Valley AI scaling route, where you're trying to get intelligence to emerge from massive amounts of data, massive compute, far more data than any human gets in their lifetime, and really with a focus on language data, and the way brains and minds seem to have approached this evolutionarily, developmentally, and culturally, where we start with being able to do these kinds of things, and then we come to be able to do those kinds of things. So the research I want to talk about is effectively trying to understand how can we capture that with math, computation, and engineering. And again, very much influenced by many people in this room, and co-developed with many of them. I would say we have at this point something like a sketch of some parts of a roadmap, okay? It starts from saying what is built in and then talking about how do you learn the rest, right? And again, that refers to several of Stan's big questions. You know, you could talk about core knowledge, or some of my colleagues prefer the term core architecture, because we're talking about systems for representation, but also other aspects of architecture that might be, for example, different kinds of goals or motivational systems, as well as different kinds of algorithms for inference and learning. And I'll talk about some of all of these things here. You know, I think a core idea that I certainly want to start and leave you with, and it goes back, like Floris made this point extremely well in his talk, and many of the others who work on prediction, is there's a very basic thing that if you had to say what is the brain for most fundamentally, I would say it's not most fundamentally for learning, although human brains do amazing feats of learning as well as other primates. But many small brains, like flies, don't do that much learning, right? But they still do remarkable things. And as we know, many of these remarkable feats of sort of modeling the world, understanding the physics of objects, other agents, are present in human brains as early as you can look. Like, for example, as Nancy Kamischer, Rebecca Sachs, and their labs have shown, scanning the brains of even two-month-old babies. Okay. But what does seem to be the most fundamental thing that brains do is what I like to call making good guesses and bets. So it's predictions, but also decisions, broadly in line with what you could call classical rationality, like this idea of having a world model that you can calibrate to perception, estimate the state of the world, do something which approximates expected utility maximizing actions. There is something just so fundamental about that. Peter Norvig called this the fundamental equation of AI, but it's really the fundamental equation of intelligence, you could say. Okay. And being able to have world models based on the core architecture, make good guesses and bets, is where we start. But then, and here's where we start to get to some human singularity, something else happens when we learn language. And you could very roughly divide human development into what you might call three phases. I'm not calling them stages because it's certainly not meant to evoke a stage theory, but learning language and then using language to learn everything else. So how close are we, or how far along are we, to trying to understand how all these pieces fit together in computational terms? Well, I think, you know, here, I look back on my own couple of decades in the field and many students and colleagues I've worked with, and I feel like we've made a bunch of progress. So much so that we decided to write this book and put it out there and charge lots of money, but also give away a free version for open access on MIT Press. This book is edited by Tom Griffiths, Nick Chater, and myself, and has contributions from many colleagues and students. And it really represents a couple of decades of work over a couple of phases of trying to build models of this central idea of how human minds make Bayesian inferences about the world, probabilistic inferences, good guesses, and decisions and plans on top of world models that often have quite a lot of structure to them. If you want to learn more about what we call probabilistic programs, here's another source. This one's completely free, only free. The probmods.org webbook by Noah Goodman and a number of others. And this is just a nice tutorial introduction to these kinds of models with code you can run in the browser, very easy to do. But the key thing here, and again, I think this hopefully this will connect to and maybe possibly contrast a little bit with some of the other recent themes here, is that the kind of models that I think we need to capture the core of rationality in brains and minds, as well as to understand how it's transformed by uniquely human practices and systems of knowledge such as language, is not just any one of the big ideas that have been developed in the mathematics of intelligence over the years. Certainly not just Bayesian or probabilistic inference, also not just the old original idea of symbolic representation, and certainly not also the old and now recently new and popular and transformative neural networks. All these ideas are really important, and probabilistic programs, especially in their modern version as we and others use them, really lie at the intersection of these and combine the power of graded gradual learning from data and association that you can do with vector differentiable programs like neural networks, but also the power of abstraction and knowledge representation that really symbolic approaches give uniquely well, as well as the ability to deal with uncertainty, generalization, and so on, as you have with probability. And in this book, you can see applications of these ideas to many domains of perceptual and cognitive inference. Okay. I'll tell you about a couple of these in a bit, but I want to highlight, especially in this talk, with connecting to Stan's themes and the human singularity especially, how language changes this picture, right? Because here is a place where the recent language models, I think, if you use them in the right way, really do unlock certain kinds of mathematics and theory building that cognitive science wasn't able to do before, as well as get at some of the big questions that I think people have been debating here, like this morning. In particular, we use language models that are code LLMs. So most of the models that you're familiar with are trained to model the joint distribution of natural languages and programming languages, human source code. And I'll show you how we're using those to capture the ways language builds on and then transforms cognition. But I think the key point here is that if you combine language models and probabilistic programs in the right way, it may give us steps towards a unifying account of these things like concepts and thoughts. And I'm very struck by some of the debates that were going on in the morning session, like between Manuela and Luca, for example, about what is a concept? Is it something like patterns of association, nodes in a semantic network? I guess everybody's ruled that out, but there's a lot of interest in this room in vectors in semantic space or cross-modal associations, or is it something more like a symbolic expression in the language of thought? Well, in my view, you're all right, but you're right about different aspects of concepts, and the tools that we're building here can show how those come together and complement each other and let minds do things that nothing besides human minds can do, and that we in cognitive science didn't have tools to understand until now. I'll show you these in a couple of settings of intuitive physics as well as intuitive psychology, with a little bit of a reference to this nice paper by Luca Schultz-Buschoff and from Eric Schultz's group and others, where they did some systematic benchmarking of state-of-the-art multimodal vision language models, so the things that capture these multimodal associations, vector concepts, and so on, using classic cognitive science experiments, some which came out of our group and others, as the experimental setting. And you know, I'll just highlight one of their conclusions, which is that in these settings of intuitive physics and intuitive psychology, understanding agents' goals and actions and so on, these models can superficially describe like what a scene looks like, but really don't get at and really don't correlate at all well with human reasoning. Okay, that means the alignment between these models and human judgments are often close to chance. So for example, in one of these intuitive physics settings, which was the basis for the work that Nancy and I did together, and at her lab, well, you saw her beautiful, amazing talk on the first morning, but we started off studying these questions of like, which way will a tower fall, or how likely is a tower to fall, in this work with Pete Battaglia and Jess Hamrick, you know, about 15 years ago. And we gave people scenes like these and asked them to judge on a graded scale, representing their uncertainty, how likely a tower is to fall or how unstable it is. And that's the mean judgments on the vertical axis. And we showed that we could capture this very well quantitatively with running a small number of probabilistic simulations in one of these approximate physics engines. So it's like the kind of physics engines that video games use. It is a reasonable, resource rational or pragmatically efficient hack on Newtonian mechanics, but it's one that can capture complex scenes just well enough to look good on short time scales, which is also what brains care about. And then we run a small number of probabilistic simulations, and that's going to be a big theme in the work in order to capture people's judgments. And this is exactly the setting as in that Schultz-Buschoff paper, which, or Buschoff-Schultz paper, showing that, via state-of-the-art vision language models are near chance. The most recent ChatGPT-5 has gotten, I'd say, significantly better at this, but there's still really big gaps. What's so striking here is that it's not only these very familiar judgments that, you know, anybody who's built Legos or blocks or played the game Jenga has made, but again, in the spirit of human singularity, I can program your mind with a new judgment. Like I can show you these tabletop scenes and ask you, which have these red and yellow blocks in various configurations, and I say, suppose I knock the table hard enough to bump some of the objects onto the floor, is it more likely to be red or yellow blocks? People can make systematic judgments here, and the very same model can capture this very well too. There's no learning in any of these models. They have a pre-existing simulation program, and somehow we imagined when we did this work that you were able to take the question and turn it into a query that a few probabilistic simulations could answer. Simulations like these. This is simulating a small bump of the table. Here's a larger bump. And the point we made was that you don't have to run very many of these simulations. You don't have to know whether it's a small or a large bump in this case. You don't have to run the simulation for very long. Just a couple of time steps of a small number of guesses of what the physics describes, we're able to capture what people do there. And in work that many folks who came out of our group have looked at, including some work that we did collaboratively with Luca and Andrew Teglis and others from his group, we showed how these models can capture many things, including infants' intuitive physics, causal counterfactual reasoning, or even how people figure out very quickly how to use novel tools. This is the work of Kelsey Allen and Kevin Smith, and that's Toby Gerstenberg. Okay. Now, where does language come into this picture? Okay, so here I'm going to very briefly channel some ideas that started with this paper, From Word Models to World Models, by Leo Wong and Gabe Grand. They're the co-first authors. Alex Lev also was a key author there. Alex is now an assistant professor at Yale. He just started up there in computer science. Gabe is still a PhD student at MIT. Leo is a postdoc at Stanford. And this paper introduces this idea of what we called rational meaning construction, which is this idea of effectively using a code LLM. At the time, we used the first codex model, which is now not anything like a state-of-the-art model. And I think it's important that these ideas work with sort of small, not very good models, because we don't have all the training data that has optimized these models since. But we use these models to model what is effectively what some linguists call a meaning function, or a probabilistic, contextual, sequential translation of strings of words into lines of code in a probabilistic programming language. And I don't have time to go into all the ways that I think this captures aspects of different semantic theories over the years, but this is what I was talking about in saying we have what is effectively, I think, now steps towards a unified theory of meaning at both the word and the phrase and sentence level. But just to illustrate, this is work that Sed Zhang did together with Leo and Gabe. We can sort of reconstruct this entire sort of mental physics engine sort of thing just in language. So we don't show people scenes here. We don't show model scenes, although we can also condition on vision. We'll do that in a second. But we describe one of these red and yellow tabletop scenes, and we take the statements like, okay, in this scene, there's one tall stack of red blocks and two short stacks of yellow blocks. And the code LLM generates a distribution on expressions in a probabilistic programming language. These are conditioning statements, which condition a scene prior of blocks and give you a scene like this. This is one scene that the model imagines in its mind. This is a snapshot of a physics simulation that is not seen, it's just constructed in the model by conditioning a prior on all red and yellow block scenes on those statements. And then now this is a runnable simulation because this is a physics engine, so you can simulate the bump and observe the result, do this a couple of times, get an inference, and so on. Here's a more complex scene. Now we're describing a scene with several stacks of red blocks and few blocks on the edges of the table. Less than half of the blocks on the edges are yellow. Again, we turn this into a few lines of code. We can simulate it and get an answer. Okay, and we can do this across a number of scenes. And here I'm just effectively replicating conceptually the same experiment I showed you before, the red and yellow thing, in terms of being able to fit human judgments. But now with no scene. Okay. All right. We can extend this to all the things you could talk about. Because I'm already running short of time, I'll skip this. But, you know, part of the point of language is anything we know can be brought to bear on the problem. So if I know something about how tall a toddler is, I can take that statement, and now that's something I can condition on. That wasn't something we even thought about before, but, you know, now it's taller scenes. Okay, fine. The same kind of idea can apply in intuitive psychology. But I think for reasons of time and being close to the end of the day, I'm just going to skip this. But I would say that the work that's been done by Rebecca Sachs and me, or students working with Rebecca and me, especially Chris Baker, Julian Hara-Edinger, and all these other people on here, is some of the work that personally I'm most proud of and that I think really reflects where this toolkit of probabilistic inference on programs that describe our core representations, in this case, how people move around in space looking for goals when they have only partial information, like in this food truck study, which I think many of you have seen, so again, I'll just sort of skip it. But it kind of replicates what is effectively like a Sally Ann false belief thing, but in a graded, spatially grounded way, where people will now make graded inferences about joint inferences about what an agent believes and desires from watching how the agent takes, there's a fundamental assumption of efficiency here, rational planning, but when you see an agent who might be going to a Korean, Lebanese, or Mexican truck, take what is apparently an inefficient path where they see the Lebanese truck turn around and go back to the previously seen Korean truck, you can infer that they were hoping it was the Mexican truck, even though you don't see the Mexican truck. But that inefficient motion is interpreted as efficient motion to a goal that could have been there and that was there in their minds. Okay. And this is something we can, again, quantitatively capture and quantitatively model people's judgments of agents' graded desires as well as their subjective beliefs. And you can make this also, you know, call it stimulus computable now from both the language and the vision stimulus. This is work that Lance Ying led together with many of the other people there, where you take these kinds of grid world scenes and you use a vision language, you know, cross-modal associative thing between images, natural language, and code to construct what are effectively the representations needed to solve these problems and replicate pretty well the very good quantitative results we had before. But if you take just the base multimodal association model, so just the VLM, it's basically a chance. And this is just the kind of thing that the Wusshoff-Schultz paper showed and others. And so it shows again that while these models capture something really important, these VLMs, about the cross-modal association and vector space structure of concepts as labeled by words, they don't actually capture the full notion of concepts that provide reference to the world, grounding in intuitive theories like theory of mind and the physics and space that sits on top of this. And so hopefully this shows how you bring these tools together to, I think, make the progress that we need. But this is still all fundamentally the core architecture and how language grounds on it. How do we go from these domains to like all these other domains that I said the tools have been built for? Because over the years, and you can read about that in that book and many papers by the folks on this, you know, slide, and it's just a small fraction, in every one of these domains, we can build these theoretically, I'd say, quite satisfying explanatory models that are quantitatively predictive, like what I showed you, but they're all these bespoke little models built by computational cognitive scientists. How do we capture the capacity of a mind to construct all these models for itself? And in some sense, this is also kind of the question of how do we go beyond core knowledge? And I want to talk about a few ways of doing that, just very quickly. So one is using language to transform our thinking. And again, this part of the talk will just be sort of advertisements for recent work. And I'll just refer you to the papers, like, for example, this really cool paper by Leo Wong and two other people I haven't mentioned yet, Katie Collins and Tyler Brooke Wilson. Tyler is an assistant professor of philosophy and cognitive science at Yale. Katie is just finished her PhD at Cambridge and is a postdoc at MIT with us. The basic idea of this paper is to try to address this challenge. The way they put it is, and this also builds on work in Tyler's MIT philosophy PhD thesis, so I refer you to that as well. It is to say, how do we understand how minds achieve what is sort of a balance between global relevance and local coherence? How are we able to think about all the things we can think about, bringing any potentially relevant knowledge to bear, and yet construct a model that actually lets us reason coherently, as we can show with the probabilistic psychophysics type experiments that we do here, in any one of these domains? And it builds on the ideas from the Word to World Models paper, but sort of extending them now to capture other aspects of language, which is associative memory, analogical retrieval, and other properties that people have talked about here, which are remarkable things that language contributes to our understanding of the world. There's lots of things that we can think about that we've never directly experienced, but we've heard about or read about. And effectively, that's what this model tries to capture by using a code LLM embedded in a probabilistic inference pipeline, basically, to capture how we construct online a bespoke model of a world for a domain. So like in this paper, we consider what we call the model Olympics domains. If you're familiar with Toby Gerstenberg's Bayesian tug of war, you might recognize this, or his Bayesian ping pong. But you model how people have these various sports matches, and then you see the outcomes of some sports matches. And again, for more than 10 years, we've been able to make models, good predictive models of judgments of how strong someone was, or how hard you think someone was trying based on a series of matches. But that was all with code that cognitive scientists wrote. Now, the model starts off with the natural language description and progressively constructs a bespoke model by going through stages of natural language and then increasingly grounding that in code. So it starts off, maybe reflecting as we might, just sort of thinking in natural language, what do we think is relevant to a situation? And then it turns that effective conceptual dependency of relevance into code that supports probabilistic inference. And this lets us not only model in a language computable way the experiments we used to do, but also gives us the ability to at least start to take steps towards modeling the open-endedness of human reasoning. So in these tug-of-war domains, I can tell you not only about who won which races, but I can just introduce all sorts of other random information that might be relevant. Like, Avery seems to have come down with a stomach virus between rounds, but has decided to compete anyway. Kay didn't get enough sleep last night and can barely stay awake during the race. Ness took an energy drink, and it just kicked in to give them extra energy for their matches. In the first match, Kay pulled a muscle in their shoulder that limited their pulling output going forward. You might ask, where did we come up with these things? And the answer is, we didn't. These were actually generated by human participants in an experiment. We asked people, having done some of these things, to now come up with just other pieces of information you might tell someone that would change their answers. And then we gave other people those pieces of information, and we said, well, how can you incorporate those into your reasoning? And we used the model synthesis architecture to do that, to take these open-ended pieces of information and construct an extension to a probabilistic program that let people reason about this. And I'll skip all the details of the experiment and the data analysis, but in short, you can model not quite so well as the simpler cases, because people are complex, and some of these things are hard to think about, at least in the fully as crystal in a coherent way, but pretty well, and much better than just having the base language model think about this. So again, it shows where those synergies are coming through. Okay, I'll skip that and just go on to the second answer, which connects back to a number of the themes that you saw with Matthias and others here too, which is and the stuff I did at the very beginning, and themes that Stan again and his whole group have influenced all of us over for many years, which is the language of thought and the idea that we also learn in and around and on languages of thought, and we can learn new languages of thought. The idea that we might have many different languages of thought to capture all the different domains we know, including ones that might be built in core knowledge, like certain kinds of languages of geometry, perhaps, right? As well as all these other domains of human expertise. This is an idea, our version of it was articulated in this TIX paper a few years ago by Josh Rule and Steve Piantedosi. And a number of other students, such as Kevin Ellis, have worked on these models for basically trying to capture how we learn new concepts and whole new domains as learning programs and even learning programming languages. So the system that Matthias referred to in his talk was a system that he actually contributed to when he was a visitor with us, but it was really led by Kevin Ellis, who's now an assistant professor at Cornell. The system is called DreamCoder, and it's a system that has, if you're familiar with wake-sleep kinds of learning, it has a kind of a little bit more, I mean, maybe a little bit more biological realism, but still very metaphorical than simple wake-sleep learning in neural networks. But the idea here is in the wake phase, that's learning to solve particular problems by writing code, like a short line of code, to represent the solution to the problem. And then there's these two sleep phases, very loosely metaphorically inspired by slow wave and REM sleep. But basically in the slow wave type sleep, you're consolidating and abstracting out common program elements in the code you wrote to solve problems during waking, and then those become new primitives in your language. So you extend your domain-specific language, you add new primitives to it, and from that you can start off actually with a very generic language and grow a domain-specific one, and grow many different domain-specific ones depending on what experience you get. There's also something more like a classic sleep mode, in which here's a neural network coming in for pattern recognition, in which you imagine as dreams new problems, you make up new problems. They're a little bit crazy, but they're drawn from your probability distribution on the problems you've experienced, and you use those as training data for a neural network. And applied to logo drawing, like Matthias talked about, this system starts off, its goal is to learn logo programs, simple drawing programs, much like the language of geometry ones that Stan and Matthias and Marie and many others have worked on. to make these kinds of shapes. But actually, many of these are quite hard, and it only comes after multiple iterations of learning to be able to write these programs. After it first solves simpler problems and then invents these new primitives. These are some of the primitives that let it now write programs for these more complex drawings, very short, very compressed, using these novel primitives. If you had to write them using the original logo language, which is just pen up, pen down, move ahead, turn, you'd never be able to find them. They're not compressive enough. But having learned a new language, now they become compressed. This was the basis of what Matthias talked about, how we learned a good representation for these more complex kinds of geometric drawings. And another thing we showed there was how you could give the system just very schematic examples of different kinds of drawing cultures, like the Greek or the Celtic sorts of drawings, and then the system would come to learn an appropriate generative model. So in that sense, it was specializing to certain kinds of domains of diagrams. And you can really see what's going on by looking at its dreams. So here's the system learning in its sleep. At the beginning, its random samples of programs are really, really boring because its language of thought, it's just sampling random programs from its language of thought, is just base logo. Not very interesting. But after 20 iterations of learning, this is what it's dreaming about. Again, kind of weird stuff, but much more complexity, and you can see what these are now, in a sense, these programs now are just as simple to it as those ones were before. To take one of Stan's tropes, you could imagine the very same system, if it was a little bit more like a baby Einstein, and we did this, giving it physics problems to solve, and then it actually constructs a library of concepts. It starts off from, again, a very minimal kind of Lisp language, but it constructs concepts of vector algebra and things that become like inverse square laws even, where again, a very complex physical law can now be written in a much more short, compact way because it has these concepts of vector products and ratios and squares and such. Okay. So I just want to leave us again, coming back, as Nancy said, it's the questions even more than the answers. So just some questions that I hope we'll all think about and that folks in our lab are currently thinking about and collaborators. Where is the real singularity here? To what extent are these capacities for program learning or learning new libraries or languages actually uniquely human? What are their various roots and origins? And even what are their neural mechanisms? So one way we've been trying to get at this is this work that was led by Tracy Mills and Sam Cheyette with collaborators in Nicole Coates and Laura Schultz in developmental psychology, and Alessandra Silva and Steve Ferrigno in working behaviorally with macaques. And this is the dot thing that I showed you. So going back to the beginning, we gave people, starting with human adults, many of these programs where these are just showing the dot sequences, and here's showing human adults making a series of judgments where over each step, they go from being kind of all over the place, but with interestingly structured uncertainty, converging to confidently knowing and knowing that they know. And what we first showed that we could model this using a kind of Bayesian inference of probabilistic programs. So it's probabilistic inference of probabilistic programs. We imagine a learner which sees just a sort observation, can generate hypotheses from a language of thought for spatial temporal programs, which is kind of like, much like the ones that Matthias and Stan have worked with, extended a little bit with some extra kinds of recursion. And then doing Bayesian inference, these are a few hypotheses in this space that are all consistent with the several examples. And notice how they're quite different. And the result is when you average over those, when you consider, well, what it might be, you get a very structured distribution of uncertainty. That's what you saw in the data here, right? Where it's not just a Gaussian. Some people are here, some people there, some people are there. It's as if, and there's a lot of other evidence for this, each person is not constructing a large number of these programs, but they're drawing a sample from the posterior. That's what the so-called one and done idea from Ed Vuhl and others. And we see really nice evidence of that when we compare the distribution of human adults with the distribution of samples from the model. Now in this latest study, which has just been submitted, we compare also with children and with monkeys, and we see something very interesting. And I don't know how to think of it, and I'd love to learn from you how to think of it. So one of the things we see is that children actually, at least 4 to 7-year-olds, look a lot like adults, but kind of noisier. Maybe it's, we actually do some careful work to show that it's not just more motor error. There's just a little bit more uncertainty. But the monkeys, while they can predict these sequences, they look very different. Okay, it's not just that they have more uncertainty, but their inductive bias, even after thousands of trials of training on very similar but not identical sequences, they do something that is fundamentally different. And it turns out the easiest way to see what's going on is to compare children, adults, monkeys, and transformers. Big surprise. Or statistical sequence models. So here I'm showing the difficulty, the relative just sort of error rate or accuracy for children of different ages compared with adults. And what you can see is that the older children are basically identical to the adults. The five-year-olds are pretty similar, maybe even four-year-olds. The three-year-olds, though, look, the three-year-olds are almost uncorrelated with adults, but they're perfectly correlated with the monkeys, okay, in terms of what things they find easy or hard. And they're all perfectly correlated with a transformer that just looks, that has a context window of size 2. That turns out to be just a small variation on just a kind of local linear extrapolation. So they're doing some kind of real prediction. It's like in Flores's work. The brain is predictive, monkeys and probably many others. Okay, but they're not doing the same kind of structured program. What's different? What changes? Is it education? Is it learning language? Is it just what parents in this culture do with four-year-olds? We'd really like to know, and we're hoping to find out. There are also, you know, and here I've been inspired by Liping's work and a number of others here, and I just mentioned some work that I know some of you know from Lucas Tian and Vinrik Friewald's lab. We are also trying to study precursors of these kinds of abilities in monkeys, where we've been teaching them, inspired by the language of geometry, to draw simple kinds of things. I'm almost done, yeah. And in work that Lucas has, some on BioArchive, others still very soon to come out in prep, we've shown that monkeys can learn very simple kinds of grammar-type systems for these drawing programs, and that they seem to be realized in a hierarchical network of both in PMV for some basic action stroke symbols, very sort of primitive action primitives, and then some more complex stuff in prefrontal cortex. Okay, and the very last thing, and again, here I want to bring it back to Stan and his birthday, is though I think there are some precursors for symbolic program induction, there are some kinds of program induction that we know are uniquely human. I want to just show you the work of another singular human that I happen to have the privilege of working with. Kartik Chandra is a really brilliant MIT PhD student, one of the few students I've worked with who's as both brilliant and polymathic, I think, as Stan. And in a paper that he's written, it's a very personal paper, but he considers the question of how can a person come to understand themselves? How could we collectively, as a culture, come to understand ourselves? Or how could a machine come to understand itself from the standpoint of program induction? And he takes the probabilistic programming language Church, and he writes a kind of a program which he calls a gogine. It's like a quine, it's a gogine. I don't even quite know how to pronounce it, but you can read his wonderful essay to see why he calls it that. But it's a program that basically, what it does is it tries to figure out itself. So by modeling its history of responses, it tries to think like, well, how do I think I work if this is the way that I thought I worked when I saw this data which I generated? So it's a completely internal reflective process, which could perhaps model in some schematic way the way at least some humans have asked themselves the same question. And he shows that actually it's not only possible, but it's actually quite reliable. If you have the right kind of probabilistic, sort of meta-recursive probabilistic programming mind, you can reliably figure out how you work. Okay, so I'll just refer you to his paper on that, and wrap up by just showing you, reminding you of the roadmap that we've been trying to lay out. What are some of the ingredients of how human intelligence scales, whether it's starting from the basic idea of rationality and the tools that bring together neurosymbolic and probabilistic paradigms for thinking about intelligence computationally, and models of core architecture, what's built in and shared with other animals, but also how language transforms our minds, and possibly even how we might start to study this in the brain. I hope I've also convinced you that Stan's charge, I think, to all of us, the question of whether math can answer the big questions of cognitive science, I think it can start to answer many of these. So thank you for your attention, and thank you, Stan.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.